During the course of the fifth age, so many problems have lost all inner vital warmth. The countless questions which confront us when we study spiritual science with any depth simply do not exist for the modern man with his materialistic outlook. A different form of experience will come to the man of modern times. In his own opinion, he knows ever so well. He observes the material world, using his intellect to establish the inner connections between its phenomena, and believes that all its riddles are solved in this way, never realizing that he is simply groping in a phantasmagoria. But this way of working coarsens and dries up his ether body, with the ultimate result that the Ahrimanic powers, like a second nature, will attach themselves to him. An excerpt from Balance in the World and Man, Lucifer and Ahriman, by Rudolf Steiner. Welcome to the Alchemical Mind. Now, this is the first time that I've actually delved into Steiner, and we're not going to go too in-depth in this episode because, while I know some of you are very studious, you might be very familiar with Steiner and Anthroposophy. For a large segment of the listener audience, you may have never read any Steiner before. You may not even know what anything that I said just means. So I'm going to do a very quick introduction to some of the terminology so that we can get into today's topic. And today's topic is really interesting. I received an email from a listener in Australia, Bailey, so shout out to Bailey, asking about the role of human evolution and artificial intelligence in our future. And I thought that was kind of an interesting question to ask in a podcast that generally deals with mystical concepts. And I wanted to approach the topic from a mystical perspective, and that's why I chose this excerpt from Rudolf Steiner. Because Steiner was very interested in the future evolution of humanity, and he kind of dove into this topic in a very mystical way. And the central concept to remember for this discussion, and of course we're going to dive into other mystical traditions as well, but the central thing to remember for this discussion is that Steiner kind of had this, sometimes it's represented as a triangle, sometimes as kind of a diamond shape, but the basic of it is really a triangle. You have in the center of the triangle, you have the Christ consciousness, and this is not necessarily relating to Jesus Christ, although according to Steiner's philosophy, Christ was kind of the physical manifestation of this, I guess you could say, archetypal entity, right? And this is where we can get into some Jungian ideas as well, because the three archetypes that Steiner plays with are going to be kind of central to our discussion. So you have this Christ archetype. Just like in the Gnostic discussion that we've had, you had the Bethos, the God above God, sending down Jesus as a physical manifestation of this logos of the word in order to recenter humanity. And this is the approach that Steiner is using in this kind of magic triangle that he bases his philosophy on. You have Christ in the middle. Before Christ, you had the Luciferian archetype. Okay, and this is not Lucifer in the way that we might understand it in modern Christianity. This is not Satan, if you will, although in some respects you can consider it that. This is really the true meaning of Lucifer, the Lightbringer. And so this Luciferian archetype kind of also manifested itself in a physical form, according to Steiner, roughly, 3,000 years before the coming of Christ. And this Luciferian force kind of brought on knowledge to humanity. Kind of like Prometheus, if you would, in the Greek sense. Prometheus, of course, brought fire to humanity, and the gods hated him for it, because the gods did not want humanity to have this knowledge. That seems to be a recurring kind of theme in a lot of these ancient traditions, right? We've talked a lot about this, for example, in Christianity, where, God, after man eats, well, man and woman, of course, eats of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, God's like, what are you guys doing? I told you not to eat it. Get out of here. You're not going to live in bliss anymore. Now you got to work hard for it. Well, that's not such a bad thing. We're going to dive into that more and more as the podcast progresses. But this theme of the gods not wanting humanity to possess this knowledge that only gods would have, Lucifer is the bringer of that knowledge. Okay, again, this is not Satan. Some of that imagery got a little intertwined over the centuries, over the millennia. You might argue, of course, and some of the Gnostic sects did, that even Lucifer, or Satan, in the Bible, the snake, the serpent, in the Garden of Eden, was also the spirit. He wasn't trying to make man fall. serpent was trying to give humanity the knowledge that the gods did not want them to possess. So Lucifer is this entity. Lucifer taught man how to grow crops, how to perform various rituals, spiritual rituals. He taught him meditation, taught him prayer, taught him psychedelic states. So plant medicine was brought about by Lucifer. And again, in Steiner's cosmology, if you will, this entity does become a physical manifestation. So there are people that are born throughout the ages that represent these core archetypes of Lucifer, Christ, and we'll get to Ahriman in a second. The third, as I said, is Ahriman. Ahriman, according to Steiner, will kind of manifest himself in a physical form somewhere around 3,000 years after the coming of Christ. So you have this, of course, sacred number 3, because we're talking about a triangle here, with the Luciferian force coming 3,000 years before the Christ spread it, with the Luciferian archetype coming to be 3,000 years before the Christ spirit, and the Ahrimanic spirit coming to manifest himself 3,000 years after. Now, we're not going to dive deep into the cosmology of what this all means, how these things interplay, but I want to throw these concepts out there so you have them in your mind for a future discussion of Steiner, because I'm absolutely fascinated by Steiner. Now, of course, if you can see the Christ archetype as being the center of this triangle, and Lucifer brings knowledge, brings spiritual knowledge, what Ahriman's purpose is to bring materialistic knowledge to humanity. And so the way that this archetype manifests itself in our consciousness is through science, through materialistic pursuits, through industrialization, through technology. And this is where I think some folks that really follow the path of anthroposophy, and not everyone, of course, and this is, of course, true of every path. Some people get it. Some people kind of take it a little too literally. Some feel that Steiner was kind of warning us against the coming of this technological advancement, where the spirit of Ahriman is trying to keep humanity down from realizing their true essence, their true nature, by only embedding us into deeply materialistic belief systems, deeply materialistic religions, and keeping us away from the spiritual. Now, what's key to remember here is that Lucifer is not a good spirit because he brings us spiritual knowledge, and Ahriman is not an evil spirit because he brings us only materialistic knowledge. See, this is the core of what's missing in a lot of these interpretations. Because the point is, we're dealing in archetypes. And again, as a huge fan of Jung, you guys know I eat this stuff up. Because for me, this is what it is all about. It's about physical manifestations of deeply embedded archetypes in the universe. And through the interplay of various forces, none of which are good or evil, they just exist, they just evolve, they move, because the universe is constantly changing. So don't think of these things as moralistic or value-based. These are simply forces that ebb and flow in the universe. And Ahriman is this next force, this next archetype, that is evolving in the universe. Now, some of this is, of course, very deeply entrenched into some ideas that the New Age fans really love, like the Age of Aquarius. Of course, the Age of Aquarius is not necessarily a New Agey thing. It's been around for thousands of years. We go through various cosmological ages, through the Zodiac. You can look all the stuff up. And sometimes people feel like, oh, the Age of Aquarius, it's going to be great, right? That's when the water bearer comes. We get the true message. That's when Christ will return, etc. None of this is true, of course. The Age of Aquarius is actually a very tumultuous time. And it's deeply entrenched in Steiner's cosmology with the return of Ahriman. Ahriman will manifest himself in a physical form, like I said, roughly 3,000 years. So about 1,000 years or so from now. And we'll continue evolving through these ages until we get to the next age. I think the next golden age, according to Steiner, is roughly around the year 5400. So that would be at the end of the Age of Aquarius, because Steiner believed that we're roughly around this time or in the next couple hundred years transitioning into the Age of Aquarius. That's when Ahriman will come about. Now, why am I talking about all this stuff? What does this have to do with this message that Bailey got me? I know Bailey's thinking that. Bailey's thinking, wait, I just asked about artificial intelligence. What does this have to do with it? So let's look at Bailey's questions, because I think they're really interesting. And like I said, I want to approach this from a metaphysical perspective, from a philosophical perspective, from a spiritual perspective. And like I mentioned in the last episode, I want to dive into these topics with a new perspective and really go deep into what this stuff means according to the mystical experience. Because even the answers to the questions that Bailey posed are answers that we've discussed many, many times before on the podcast. Sometimes they might seem like really nice sayings, right? Like, have no fear, you are it, the kingdom of God is within you, all these things. But see, what makes the mystical experience, the mystic, what sets him or her above other religious figures who simply dive into these things in a very literal interpretation, instead of looking at the meaning behind it, instead of finding the archetype in the middle, the Christ spirit. And again, this is not a Jesus thing, it's not a Christian thing. Christ spirit, the figure that lives in the middle, the God that is just as high above as he is down below. God in the middle. This is, of course, very familiar with some of the stuff that we talked about from Jung in the Black Books in the previous episode. Now, Bailey asked five questions. They're all interrelated. In fact, Bailey and I have been kind of going back and forth a little bit via email. She just sent me a giant tome. I love the discussions that I have with you guys via email. They're sometimes much more in-depth than what we can do on Twitter or even on Discord. And Bailey's last reply, she wrote me a text document. It was amazing. It's like 4 or 5 pages long. And so we're going to be going further and further into this stuff because Bailey's working on this kind of fictional novel based on these ideas. And maybe she wants to get some juices flowing. I don't know. All I know is I also love to get my juices flowing. So I'm really enjoying my conversation with her. Here are the 5 questions that Bailey proposed. And we're going to dive into these kind of all at once and then maybe pick out some of the different things as we go along in the discussion. So number 1 is, what are your thoughts on humanity being a stepping stone for the evolution of artificial intelligence? Very interesting. Should we fear the potential of using our humanity? Well, I agree that individuals are not special. Do you think that humanity itself is special? Is there a case for staying human forever with technological augmentation versus evolving into something new, as in AI or the singularity? And do you think that a simulation that we create to mimic fear and the unknown is a trap? Beautiful questions. Really deep questions. And I know the focus of the podcast has oftentimes been about spirituality and ritual and meditation and practice and reading. But do you ever take the time to think about some of these bigger questions? Now, of course, sometimes the best way to find the answers to the bigger questions is not to think about them at all. You see, oftentimes we look and look and look. We look for answers. We look for God. And then we realize we knew the answers all along. God was with you all along. These aren't two separate things. They're just different interpretations of the same archetype. If God is knowledge and wisdom and love and all things, so including all opposites, light and dark, good and evil, etc., the thing that we are seeking always has the same answer. And we find that answer not through looking, not through knowing, but through unknowing. See how these themes kind of circle around every single time to the same thing? Because that is the mystical experience. That's how we find the answers to these questions. Now, of course, it doesn't mean don't look. It doesn't mean don't read. It doesn't mean don't listen to podcasts. Don't think about it. Don't write essays on it. Don't write fiction novels on it. Don't do the practice. Don't do the rituals. Don't do your prayer. It doesn't mean any of these things. Those are all part of the process. But it doesn't mean that you're going to arrive at the answer by doing any of these things. Because, and I'm sure many of you have experienced this very directly, and the direct personal experience is what matters. Many of you have experienced it, that you think about something. How do I fix this? How do I fix this problem? I'm stuck on this question at school. What do I do? Well, for example, if you're in school and you're taking a test and you get to an answer that you don't know, and the test is timed, what do? You don't spend the rest of your time trying to figure out this one problem. You put a mark on it, you move on to the next one. And hopefully you can answer that, and you answer the next one, and the next one, and the next one. And the question that you're stuck on remains in the background. Because the test is timed, right? If you're in school, you're in a period, whatever it is, 45 minutes, an hour, hour and a half, 2 hours. Some kind of standardized test, we'll say. Now, if all this stuff is computerized now, and again, I haven't been in school in, you know, almost 20 years. Not quite that long. About 16 years since I graduated from college. Now, we, of course, did everything in paper. So it was very easy to go back. I'm sure you can still do that, right? Like if you go to the DMV, right, the Office of Motor Vehicles to get your license, and you have to take the driving test, the skills test on the computer, You can skip a question and then come back to it later. So I'm sure there's some method of doing that. So this is what you do. You skip the question that you know nothing about, that's got you stuck, and you move on because you want to get the points. You want to rack up the points, and you go and you answer the easier questions. And then at the end, when you get to the end and you have time, you go back to the question that you were stuck on. Now, a couple things happen, of course. In the time that you were waiting and you were doing the other questions, your brain does not actually quit looking for the answer to that problem. What your brain does is move the question down into the subconscious because it's not part of your direct personal experience at that point. The direct personal experience is the question that you're working on at that particular moment. But see, your mind wants to find the answer to that question. And so it brings it down into the subconscious. It continues working through it, not spending any direct energy because your focus, the energy that it takes for you to stay focused on one thing, is not an infinite amount of energy. It's very finite. What is very infinite is the energy that lives in your subconscious. If you want to consider this maybe, your soul, let's say. Go ahead and do that. That's fine. It takes it away from your mind and brings it down into the soul, into the place where all things exist and all things are possible, where all possibilities are. Okay? This is an infinite realm because infinity includes all possibilities. And so therefore, the energy there is infinite. Now, you'll never hear this in scientific circles, of course. If you read about a paper about the subconscious, you may see some language that seems a little flowery that may relate someone to a mystical experience, but you're never going to hear anyone talking about souls or infinite energies or possibilities, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? So when you read these things, try to read them in the language of the person that's writing it. Just like when we talk about mystical experiences, we try to understand the language that experience is written in. Because, of course, remember the story of the elephant and the blind man, the story that I love. Why do I love the story? Because it's a story of us. It's a story of culture, story of philosophy, of religion, where a group of blind men are taken to an elephant and they're placed at different parts of the elephant and they're asked, describe the elephant to me. And of course, one touches the leg and he's like, oh, it's like, the giant chunk of a tree. Another touches the tail and says, oh, the elephant's like a snake. Maybe one touches the ear and he's like, oh, it's like a palm frond or a shell, right? Now, of course, none of these things describe the elephant. If these people were not blind, if they were able to see what the elephant looked like, then they would know exactly what the elephant looks like, for the most part. Of course, there's things they couldn't see, right? Any microscopic organisms, things like that, they wouldn't be able to see. But at least they would have a picture of what the elephant is, okay? But as we go through trying to find answers for ourselves, this is how we view that knowledge. We do not have all experiences. That's why there's so many different ones of us. That's why there's so many different organisms, so many different ecosystems, so many different planets, galaxies, etc. These are all manifestations of God. God trying to find what it is like to be God. This is kind of weird for some people to think about. How can God know that God is God? Well, if God is all possibilities and all opposites equally at the same time, then of course, by that sheer magnitude of existence, of wisdom and knowledge, omnipotence, God has the ability to deceive himself or herself, however you want to view it, that he is or is not God. And so through the constant evolution and changing of the system being the universe, physical and non-physical, this dimension, other dimensions, okay, remember, possibilities are infinite. God is experiencing what it's like to be me, what it's like to be you, what it's like to be my dog, my cat, my fish, trees outside, my kids, my wife, my friends, your friends, my state, my country, this planet. Okay? These are all different experiences of God. Because for God to be infinite, God must be able to experience all possibilities. And this is a topic that we're going to dive into maybe next episode or maybe the one after, because I've received a few emails this week, and this was kind of a central topic of one of these emails that I received. I believe this listener was also from Australia, so shout out to Australia for providing the amazing emails. So let's get back to Bailey's questions, because some of these are things that we've touched upon before. What are your thoughts on humanity being a stepping stone for the evolution of artificial intelligence? There's a couple things to remember here. And I've seen this be discussed in some regards by some people, but we constantly have this feeling that anything that we create is unnatural, is artificial. And this is not true. Anything that we create is just as natural as anything that nature creates. And why is that? Very simple. If all that exists is God, or the divine, if you want to be materialistic about it, the universe, if all that exists is that, then all things included in that system are created as a result of that. So you have God, God creates the universe creates galaxies, the galaxies create planets, or let's say stars, the stars create planets, the planets create dirt and water and eventually life, and life begets life. So in a sense, all things that are natural are artificial, because the root word for artificial is something that is created. That's why I always ask you guys to spend some time reading and to read beyond just the stuff that you might only be interested in, right? It's cool that I love fiction. I love science fiction. And I could, of course, spend the rest of my life reading just science fiction. But will I learn something from that? Will I get something out of it? Of course, you'll get anything out of anything that you read. But then I'm sticking around in my circle, in my comfort zone. And science fiction may be one of these genres that are particularly well suited to dive into questions of philosophy and spirituality and religion. But this is true of anything that you read, because anything that's outside of your comfort zone is things that are not part of your direct personal experience. And if you want to learn to experience the nature of the divine, what you need to do is go beyond your own personal experience and try to experience things the way that others might experience them. That's why I love when I get these emails from folks. That's why I love having conversations on social media. Why I love chatting with folks on Discord. Because as many experiences as I've had, I'm only a human being. And so I'm a very limited perspective of reality. I can never know all there is to know, nor would I hope to know everything that there is to know. Because then I wouldn't be just a manifestation of God, right? I would be God itself. And this is an impossibility. And so by going through these interactions with others, I can learn from their experience and enhance my own perspective. We've talked about this a lot previously. And of course, I've talked about Jordan Peterson, whom I don't agree with most of anything he says. But he does have a very valid point in terms of looking at these things when we dive into social, cultural, political issues. With the left banging on the right banging on the left, everyone's wrong, everyone's right, well, what is it? See, that just puts us in a worse place because nobody wants to listen to anybody. And so we see this represented in these archetypes that Steiner talks about, right? You might see maybe the right being sort of this Luciferian force in some ways. In many ways, it's also a leftist force. We're just going to pick one. We're just going to pick one at random. Folks that deal more in the spiritual. And then maybe folks on the left that deal more in the materialistic and the way to better society are more on the Aramonic side. And so you have this constant flux back and forth between the two, and nobody can ever get along. Why is that? Because nobody wants to meet in the middle. Nobody wants to meet in this Christ archetype. The archetype that understands both left and right, right and wrong, black and white, good and evil, etc. But doesn't directly identify with any of these things. Right. This is one of the things that we kind of lost, to reference back the idea of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. We don't understand what that means. That's why we have this crazy crisis inside us, especially today. There's so much mental health issues today because nobody knows what to believe anymore. Does that mean that we've lost the knowledge of good and evil? Because if we had that knowledge, we would know that one cannot exist without the other. And so we would live in the center. We would live in this Christ consciousness. In the spirit of, as Jung would call it, the phanis, Orpheus, right? And you have this very similar idea with Steiner's Lucifer and Ahriman, which are somewhat loosely based on the idea in Zoroastrianism of Ahura Mazda and Ahriman, or in the Mithraic circles of, I believe it's Asmandus and Ahrimanos. And these are all the same figure, the same archetype. Because, of course, there's never anything new to talk about. There's never anything new to talk about. All these ideas have come before. What's that quote from Battlestar Galactica? I love that show. If you've never seen Battlestar Galactica, go check that out. Especially the early seasons. Fantastic. And I believe part of the central plot of Battlestar Galactica is actually based on a Mormon story. Because the Mormons, and we haven't delved into them, maybe we will at some point, in some regards have some similarities to things like Scientology. I know if you're a Mormon, you might hate to hear that. But I'm not hating on Mormonism, just like I'm not hating on Scientology. I think all belief systems, at their core, have some kernel of truth, because they're looking at the elephant through different perspectives. But at the mystical, deep-down core, the Mormons have this idea of the planet Kobol. And that's why that's kind of the ultimate goal, right? That's how you get to the third heaven, or in Steiner's perspective, maybe the eighth sphere, right? Going beyond the seven planetary bodies. Maybe in Christianity, it's the seventh heaven. I was talking about this with my dad recently, actually, because he asked me what I thought about this idea, and we discussed it a bit. Now, any intelligence that we create is not necessarily artificial. Especially if it is a conscious intelligence. And I think usually when people talk about things like AI, they're talking about conscious beings, conscious artificial beings. That's a contradiction. Think about it. Does that make any sense to you? If it's artificial, how can it be conscious? Well, it can't, because consciousness is one, it's all pervasive. And so if a being that is created, we'll say a robot, I mean, it could be an android, it could be a synthetic, a biosynthetic entity. If it's conscious, it's not artificial. It's a real natural entity. And I mean, you can get into really deep down specifics and go into minutia if you'd like. I mean, is my cup of coffee a conscious entity? I would say almost everybody would say, of course not. It's a cup of coffee. How could that be conscious? Well, of course, it depends on how we define consciousness. And we're going to do that this episode, because that would be, a 12-hour episode. And we're trying to talk about artificial intelligence and the future of humanity. But I would argue that there is consciousness in the cup of coffee. Now, it might not be the consciousness that we as humans have, but there is some element of consciousness. Because if it didn't have an element of consciousness, it would not exist. The physicality aspect is just a byproduct of the conscious element of the cup of coffee. Again, we're not going to dive into that. But this kind of goes to the point. If we create artificial intelligence and it has self-conscious, it knows that it exists, then it's a natural thing. This is a topic that, of course, if you are into psychedelics, into entheogens, this is a discussion that is very heated in those circles. And why is that? I used to be kind of of the same mind, right? So I remember, like, when I was in high school, right, and I first tried weed, for example, or mushrooms, and I tried other things, and I would say to myself, well, I don't like acid, right? I don't like LSD. Because that's a manufactured substance. I prefer weed or mushrooms, because they come from nature. And there is an argument to be had for that. In fact, in the first episode of the new season of Hamilton's Homeworkopia, they kind of dive into this, because Hamilton's talking about 5-MeO and how by people ingesting this toad venom, they're driving the toad to extinction, and how he and others have synthesized synthetic 5-MeO, and the experience is the same. And of course, there's many detractors in the audience that say, well, it might be the same substance chemically, but because it does not come from the natural animal source, it doesn't contain the spirit of the molecule. And so it's not the same. You might have the same trip, but you won't get the same experience. You won't learn the same thing afterwards, because it's not a natural thing. It's man-made. And man doesn't know better than nature does. Okay, valid argument, but is it true? Because again, if all things emanate from God, then does that not make anything that we create just as natural as anything that God would create? Because God is simply manifesting those things through us. See, it all depends on your cosmology, how you understand the interplay of various elements of the universe. And in a very mystical sense, there are no separate things. In fact, oddly enough, if you go deep down to some of the science, there are no separate things. Now, of course, you can ask the question, how do you know that the AI that you created is conscious? Valid argument, valid question. Now, I would turn this around and ask you, how do you know that you're conscious? How do you know? And you might say, well, of course I'm conscious. I'm a human being. I think about things. I look out. I make choices. I have free will. I do this. I do that. I do the other. Of course I'm conscious. Okay. Well, that's from your personal experience. That's great. That's the way they should do it. Analyze these things through your personal experience. But I guarantee you, 99% of people, when you ask them this question, they immediately blurt out the answer. Why? Not because they know, because that's what they've been raised to know. That's what they've been raised to believe. And so you stump them when you ask them, is this cup of coffee conscious? Well, absurd, of course not. Well, why is that? It's because the experience that the cup is having is different from your own experience. And you can only relate to that which is your own personal experience. So if the experience of being Martin is obviously different from the experience of being a cup, then the cup can't be conscious. Because I'm conscious and that's not me, and so that's not conscious. And the same is true for artificial intelligence. Now, does it mean that we are the evolutionary step into AI? I mean, the simple answer, of course, is yes. Because how is AI going to be created? The cup of coffee is not going to create artificial intelligence. It does not have the tools to do so. It does not have the means nor the skills. Because the purpose of the cup of coffee is to hold coffee or any liquid. It's a cup, it's a vessel. But you could argue the same for us. You could argue the same for us. What if you are just a vessel and your purpose, the liquid that you are meant to hold, is an extension of God's ability to manifest things further? What if God wanted to experience what it's like to create other things that can experience the ability to create? And what if that is your purpose? Is your purpose to get up in the morning and work a 9 to 5 and live a boring life and come home and, do whatever, watch YouTube videos? I mean, that's an aspect of your existence, but that's not your purpose. Now, I'm not saying I know what my purpose is, nor that most of you will know what your purpose is. The purpose of our existence is to find out what that purpose might be. And we do that not through pursuing particular things, but through getting down in the river and floating downstream. We allow the universe to evolve around us so that it may lead us to what our purpose might be. Now, the problem, of course, is trying to rationalize the free will aspect with the aspect of purpose, of determinism. And that is not a discussion we're going to have today because, again, that's also a 12-hour episode. But this ties into the idea of artificial intelligence. What if our purpose is that? What if that's why we evolved into an agrarian society, into an industrial society, into a scientific society, into a technological society, and now, further and further as we dive into the future, into a post-industrial, post-technological, and eventually maybe singularity-style society? Now, I don't like the term singularity because it means that there is a point at some point in the future in which all these things will be achieved and the universe is constantly evolving. God is always changing. And that's just a stupid idea to think that there will be that one point when all these things will be revealed. Just like when we dive into some of these aspects from a religious perspective, and everyone's constantly hoping for the return of Jesus. Jesus will come back and take us up on a cloud and take us all to heaven, and we'll live happily ever after. Well, the problem with that is you've never read the Bible, and the Bible doesn't say that. Now, there are, of course, allegories and stories that allude to that being the case, but those don't come from the messenger. They don't come from Jesus. Go read the Bible again. Go read the Bible again. And this is true of anything else, right? There's not some ultimate goal where everything will be fixed. The thing is, we want all these things to be fixed. But that's not the way the universe works. The way the universe works, the way the nature of God is constant change. Creation, evolution, destruction. Constantly. Over and over and over. So you're not going to go and do your meditation, maybe go to a monastery, become a monk, whatever. Read the sutras, read the Bible, read all this stuff. Perform the rituals, do the prayers, cleanse yourself. Not eat unclean things. You're not going to be a drug addict. Okay, cool. Great. All that does is give you a different experience. But you're doing all these things. You're not going to become a Christ body. You're not going to become a Buddha. You're not going to be enlightened. You're not going to return to the Pleroma. And then that's that. All these things will continually evolve. You might get to that state, and then what's going to happen? That information gets integrated into the, we'll say, quote-unquote, body of God, and then re-disseminated onto the universe with new perspective. And so the universe continues changing. And so as we go through these technological ages, through learning all these skills, through creating new technology, we may at some point create a conscious entity that we can truly deem as artificial intelligence. And not necessarily artificial intelligence like we see it now. Something that will be truly conscious, that will be self-aware. Because you can argue, right now there are, of course, AIs. There's AI everywhere. And not just in your phone, right? Not just with Siri or, you know, Google or what's the other one? Alexa. Not through these things. These things are smart, but they're not self-conscious. And there's, of course, an argument to be made that these things are no more conscious than we are. Because as we go through our lives, we don't actually think about the things that we do. We react instinctually based on a paradigm that our brains create as we grow and experience things. And so that's why different people may choose different answers to different questions, why they may pursue different paths to different problems, because they're basing it on the experiences they've had before. That's all you can do. That's why it's important to always expand your experience so that you become a better and better person. You'll never be a perfect person, but you can sure as hell be a better person, be a better human being. And this goes into this idea of artificial intelligence. Because as Bailey asked, should we be afraid of losing our humanity? And my very simple question for her was, do we know what it means to be human? Think about that for a second. Do you know what it is to be human? Now, of course, you know that you're a human being, but how do you know? You've been told you're a human being. How do you know? What does it mean to be human? Think about that. What entails a human? What separates a human from a dolphin or a cup of coffee or a tree? Now, I purposely picked different aspects of conscious manifestation, right? I picked living things, I picked non-living things, I picked mammals, I picked non-mammals. I picked something quote-unquote natural and something quote-unquote artificial. What separates us from those things? What makes you human? Do you ever think about these things? Because I guarantee you, most people, when you ask them, do you know what it is to be human? They'll say, yeah. I mean, humans, we have two legs, two arms, we have a head. We have language. We have creative thinking. We create art. We create architecture. We have the scientific method. We create philosophies. We have imaginations. We have the ability to look at the past and imagine the future. And we have reversible thumbs, so we can hold things. That's what it means to be human. Well, you didn't tell me what it means to be human. You just told me maybe what you are. What if you're an amputee? What if you have no legs? Is that person not human because they don't have legs? Is a pirate not human because he lost his hand, now he's got a hook hand? Pirate's still human. You mentioned art. What if you're a terrible artist? Are you not human then? What if you're not a scientist? Are you not human? What if you're stuck in a coma and you don't have reasoning thinking? Is that person not human? What if you suffered some brain trauma and you lose your memory? You can't think about the past. Are you not human anymore? What if you go, say, what if you reach some crazy mystical insight and experience and you no longer think about past, present, and future? Are you no longer human? This last one's something that fascinates me, of course, and I've talked about this quite a bit. In fact, it came up, I was on Twitter recently, and I can't remember who brought it up, but there was an interview with Lou Elizondo, who worked at the ATIP program. For the government, and he compared the experience that we have of time to the experience of what he called the others might have of time, and I think he used a cigarette as the metaphor, where you have the cigarette, the body of the cigarette that's not burning, as the future, the section where the amber is lit as the present, and the ash as the past. That would be how we view it, but maybe these other entities, whatever they might be, they don't view it that way. They view the ash and the ember as one thing, past and present as the same. And maybe they view the body, the unburnt body of the cigarette, as the future. That's interesting. How does that change your perspective on things when you no longer see an aspect of the evolution of time very differently? Of course, I've talked about this before because you guys know I love linguistics, and this is this is a thing that gets played around a lot in linguistics, the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis. Go check it out. In which there's a hypothesis, and there's very different variations of this, where the way that a culture views the aspect of time, the way they represent it in the language completely changes their perspective on the world. This is actually, you know, according to me at least, partially true with cultures that look at the location the same way. I know that there's an Aboriginal tribe in Australia. They don't use ordinal directions, right? So it's not a left, right, front, back thing. It's a north, east, west, south thing. And think about how your perspective on the world changes when you constantly are aware of the exact spatial directions of the environment around you. It's very different. It's much more clear, right? Because if I'm talking to you right now and I say, look to your left, well, what's your left, right? If you were sitting in front of me and I say, look to your left, you will look to my right. Okay, that's a good instruction. But what if I say, let's look left? Now then it gets to more specific cues, right? You might look to your left unless you see me look to my left. If I look to my left, you might look to what you think I want to look at, which is your right. Let's see, if I say, look north, it doesn't matter where we are in the world, north is north. And the same is true for this idea of losing humanity. I mean, if we don't know what it is to be human, what is there to lose? And of course, if we don't know what there is to lose, why is there something to fear? Again, I've done episodes on fear. So of course, my answer is, well, there's nothing to be afraid of. And that's an easy thing to say, as I mentioned in the previous episode, in which I realize sometimes I talk about these things and I'm just like, well, crap. Of course, it has to be this way, until I actually go through some kind of process, some experience in which those things prove themselves to be true or not true. And then you adjust. That's how you become a better human. You don't say, oh my God, I just realized that there's a God and God's right here. What the hell does this mean for, you know, the past 38 years of my life? Well, nothing. All that stuff is irrelevant. It's already passed. Who cares? You reanalyze yourself based on new experiences that you get, and you move forward. And this is the way that it's going to be with evolution. Should we be afraid of artificial intelligence? No. And see, a lot of folks that follow Steiner's work have this idea that you know, our harmonic spirit is going to do this technology takeover, right? The transhumanists, the transhumanist agenda. There's always an agenda, right? You have the New World Order agenda, you have the government agenda, you have the rich elite agenda, the reptilian agenda. And now we have a transhumanist agenda, because there always has to be some bad guy that we have to be afraid of. Why? Why can't you just experience? Well, your answer is simple, because people are weak. People are easily frightened of the things they don't know. And so people take advantage of those things and use those ideas to gather an audience and maybe make some money. And the thing is, I mean, I don't care. I've talked about this many times. Sure, I have a patron. Do I talk about it? Of course. Do I force people to go on join? No. Is there some content on there that you can't get unless you're a patron? Sure. Is it invaluable to the experience of the podcast? Of course not. Of course not. Because see, the purpose of me doing this podcast is for me to learn. And how do I learn? By engaging with listeners and having great conversations. So that we can talk about topics like artificial intelligence on a spirituality podcast. Now, I think the most interesting part of the questions that Bailey asked is my thoughts on the future of this. Now, this is a little more complicated. Now, of course, there's no right or wrong answer either. And this is a question that, you know, technologists have been asking for the past at least 100 years. You could argue in some ways for thousands of years, right? You have in Greek mythology some figures that you could consider robots. You see this in Chinese mythology, too. There's plenty of robots in Chinese mythology. So this is not a new question, right? Even before these things were a reality, we have this capacity to imagine, and through that imagination, come up with answers. And that's important. That is part of what makes us human, having that capability, the ability to contemplate infinite potentials. We might not be able to understand infinity, but you could argue infinity doesn't exist either. All infinity is the capacity, the potential to potentiate, because you can never reach infinity, right? There's not that point in the future where you will reach infinity. You just keep moving on and on and on and on to the next thing. There's that that awesome thought experiment about the Grand Hotel. Look it up. It's awesome. I love it. You have a hotel. It's an infinite hotel. All the rooms are booked. And a new guest comes to the hotel and says, I need a room. And the person at the hotel just says, oh my God, the infinite hotel, it's full. How are we going to fit this person in? And the coworker says, well, it's easy. Just move the guest in room 1 to 2, the guest in room 2 to 3, the guest in 3 to 4, the guest in 4 to 5, the guest in 5 to 6, and 6 to 7, 7 to 8, 8 to 9, 9 to 10, and so on, and put the new guest in room 1. That's infinity. Very simple. You don't need to think and imagine what it might be like. There's another thought experiment that I've used several times on the podcast, one that I love, one that my buddy DJ loves. I think he and I talked about this. We might have talked about it on a phone call. I can't remember. But the idea of an infinite circle. Imagine an infinite circle. And 99% of you will just see a really big circle in your mind's eye. Well, that's not an infinite circle. An infinite circle has no boundaries. And so basically what you would picture would be nothingness. And this is the way that going through these technological advancements and states and going into AI and maybe some kind of transhumanist state in which mind and machine unite as one, that's only one possible aspect. And of course, you guys know I love Graham Hancock. Graham Hancock has talked about something similar, right? When he talks about things like the Young Dryas hypothesis, maybe there was some ancient, very advanced civilization, right? Not necessarily spacefaring, but advanced. A civilization that had culture and architecture and art, maybe navigation, you know, things like that. Some folks like to go even further. Maybe these civilizations had nuclear weapons, right? I hear this a lot when people interpret things like the Mahabharata with these gods that flew around in flying machines and exploded the landscape in this giant war and contaminated the landscape so that it was unlivable. Sounds like nuclear weapons, sure. But Graham talks about these things and how there could have been this civilization. And why is it no longer around? Well, it's very simple. Think about our culture now. If an asteroid hit and took out the grid, and we had no electricity, how long would it take to rebuild that? What if it fried all electrical equipment? Well, that's tough, because then we have to build the machines to create the components, to create the other components, to get the next component to create the machines. And, we've gone through this process over 200 years, we'll say. That's a lot of man hour, a lot of effort, a lot of time, a lot of resources, a lot of money. How long would it take? There was a TV show, I think it was called Revolution, that kind of delved into this. And that was a little more complicated because maybe there was a machine that was causing machines not to work. Maybe. My wife and I are currently watching Chernobyl. And so this is one of the aspects in Chernobyl, because they try to send robots to clear the radioactive debris. And, the radioactivity messes with electrical components. And so none of the robots work. So they have to send people. And so according to Graham, this technology existed. These cultures existed. But they're no longer around because when their technological basis was destroyed, all the components of the civilization were too specialized. So there weren't generalists. There weren't, like a handyman, right? A handyman will know how to fix a hole in the wall, maybe change a light switch, pour some concrete. He might know a little bit of plumbing, etc. So that's a generalist, handyman. But, say a nuclear physicist. Well, what's the nuclear physicist going to do now? There's no electricity. So now he's, now he's got no money. Now he's homeless. He's got no stocks and bonds, right? His money's gone because he keeps it all in the bank. And, my grandma that keeps her cash under the bed, she's rich now. Might only have, a couple hundred bucks, but she's rich because all her money is with her. And the people that had their money in the banks don't have money. So, they're screwed. And now the skills that they've spent their entire lives working on are useless because that's not part of the culture anymore. And so he argues that, hunter-gatherer tribes and things like that, shepherds, maybe people with very generalized agricultural means would survive because those people knew how to survive. They knew how to survive the winter. They knew how to make clothes. They knew how to, find berries, where to find food, what plants to eat, what not to eat, what was poisonous, what was not poisonous, what mountains to stay away from so the bears don't come and eat you. And the people that just had this very specialized knowledge don't have that, and so they go away. They disappear eventually, or maybe end up joining some of these tribes, right? And their knowledge gets lost because it's not useful anymore. We see some of this stuff going on now, right? So Elon Musk wants to send people to Mars within a few years, right? Like 2030 maybe, do a colony there. There's talk of setting up a base on the moon by NASA and the Chinese and a bunch of other people. The UAE is sending probes to Mars, all this kind of stuff. Why is that? Right? Well, for one, there's nothing wrong with that. So we shouldn't be afraid of that. We shouldn't be afraid of going out into space and colonizing. Because if we stay stuck here, the reality is that we won't survive because we're on one planet. And this is not a new idea either. People talk about this all the time. There's nothing wrong with that. The path is what's interesting because I think there's several different paths that can arise. And this is, of course, why I love science fiction, because science fiction deals a lot in these topics. One series that I'll highly, highly recommend is Foundation. Foundation series is incredible. And at the core of it is this new science that's created. That basically, I mean, essentially, you're finding a way to determine possibility through analysis, right? The psychohistory is the term used. That through the analysis of behaviors, you can find out how things will act and react and evolve, and you can determine any event in the future as a result. That's pretty interesting. Is it feasible? I don't think so, but it is an interesting idea to contemplate. Because maybe with the technology that we have now, it's not possible. But what if we become, a level one society, a type one society? What if we can use the processing capabilities of an entire galaxy to determine outcomes? What if we can use a galaxy as a computer, basically? Would we be able to go through all those variables, right? That's interesting. People are working on these kind of things, right? You have the idea of quantum computing. Now, of course, I don't think that everyone would choose this path. I personally would not choose this path. See, I'm not like the Amish. The Amish hate technology, right? And there's different groups, right? Some people might only ride red buggies, some only yellow buggies, some only white buggies, but they're still riding buggies. Some people might say, well, the tractors are very helpful for growing crops, so we can use tractors, but no phones, no cars. Now, I'm not saying don't go into space. I want to go to space. I want to see what it's like out there. I want to have that experience. I'm not saying don't have an Alexa in your home, or what's the one people were worried about, the Ring doorbell, right? Because the police can look in on your Ring doorbell. I'm not saying don't have that. I'm not saying Elon wants to do the Neuralink, right? Implant the chip in your brain. I'm not saying don't implant the chip in your brain, but you really need to look at these things in the view of this Christ consciousness, right? Of this central unifying archetype of the universe. Because there's no technology that it is inherently good or evil. There's no technology that's inherently good or evil. It is in how we use the technology and how we create systems around the technology and the knowledge that arises as a result of that. That really makes a difference. And of course, you have that famous quote when the nuclear bomb was exploded, "I am become Death Destroyer of Worlds." Of course, it wasn't Oppenheimer's quote. He got that from Hindu texts, but it's very pertinent, right? Now, sure, you can argue he had to know that if he creates a nuclear bomb, people are going to use it to kill other people. Of course, he had to have thought of that. But the thing is, did that weapon need to be used? Now, in war, we've only used it during that time, right? During World War II. We've had a lot of scares, right? The Cold War in particular. Those of you who might be a little bit older, maybe lived through that stuff. We had those scares, but we didn't have to worry about actually using the technology. But the technology's there. Now, what about the good side of the technology? You can do nuclear power plants and have, nearly infinite energy created out of that. And I say nearly infinite, not in a universal sense, but in terms of a very minuscule perspective. Now, bad things can happen, of course. And I just mentioned my wife and I are going through the HBO series Chernobyl. If you haven't seen it, it's incredible. And they deal a lot in these kind of things. In the idea of the way things look and the way things really are. And that's, of course, the key point of the mystical experience. Is in realizing the true nature of things and not the way things appear to be. Dive deeper and deeper into this. And so for some, you might say, well, if we start implanting chips into ourselves, we have RFID tags in our palms of our hands, the mark of the beast, all this stuff. You hear this kind of crap all the time. Of course, those are possibilities. But those things are only possibilities when you allow them to be possibilities. I see this kind of stuff all the time. And I don't know if I'm naive for thinking this. Maybe I am naive for thinking this. Maybe I'm too much of an idealist. Because before I really became involved in spirituality and philosophy, I was very fascinated with social political theory. And so I studied quite at length things like the origins of democracy, the origins of socialism, communism, libertarianism, etc. All these isms and how these systems evolve and the consequences of people's actions in creating these systems. And so, again, maybe I'm being a little naive, but if a government decides to instill a microchip in my forehead, let's say, we'll just do that because, I love this idea of the mark of the beast being some chip in your head or on the palm of your hand. We'll just say that. If some government decides you don't need to have no more credit cards, no more driver's license, no more whatever, no more passports, nothing. All you got to do is have this chip implanted in you, and you can go wherever you want. Well, then, you have issues where you can be tracked. People know what you're doing. These things can keep a history of your location, a lot of other things. Yes, that's true. But do you not partake in your government? And again, I'm not talking politics here. I'm not talking politics. I'm talking about actually participating in the culture that you exist in. Do you not participate? And I'm not talking about every 4 years or 6 years or whatever, depending on where you are in the world, to go vote. That's not participating. When you go vote, you're not participating. You're doing a gesture. That's not participating. In a religious context, it's like going to church on Sundays or synagogue on Saturdays or temple, whenever, special occasions. All right, if you're a Christian and you only go to church, say, on Christmas Day, that's a gesture, right? You're not participating in the process of being part of this community. You're going on Christmas Day because, well, it's Jesus' birthday, which it's not. It's Jesus' birthday, and, it'd be so nice to go to church on Jesus' birthday. So I'm going to do that, okay? But you're not participating, right? Because part of the message that is given in the New Testament is to, part of being a Christian is to congregate. Part of being a Christian is to congregate. Now, how this message is interpreted is up to you, right? So I recently had this discussion with my dad and his wife, and the way that they interpreted the message is that means that if church is on Sundays and Wednesdays, I go to church on Sundays and Wednesdays because the message says that we have to congregate. To which my reply was, well, the Christians in the early church didn't have churches. They went to each other's houses because if they had a church, they would be killed. So that doesn't mean that I have to go to church on Sundays and Wednesdays. It means that I have to sit down with you and her and have these conversations, and I can go on my podcast and have these conversations. That's congregating. I'm congregating. I'm talking about these things. I'm sharing my ideas. I'm listening to yours. I incorporate them into me to better my experience. That's congregating to me. Again, this is not a discussion for this episode, but it's relevant. So if you want to participate in a government that you oftentimes, not always, there's countries that don't have the option to elect their representatives and cannot participate because they got to a point where they're like, I only participate by voting every 4 years, so it's fine. And, I live in a red state and I vote blue, so who cares? I'm not going to vote because it doesn't matter. And so what happens is things don't go your way, and they don't go your way, and they don't go your way. And then you get to a point where it goes nobody's way because it only goes the way of the people that are governing. And then you're in a place where, well, now you have to have the sign of the beast on your forehead or on your wrist, right? You got to put the microchip on. That's your fault. That's nobody else's fault but your own. But it's much easier to say, oh, well, the government made me do this. The pedophile elite made me do this. The reptilians, it's their agenda. No. There's always groups vying for power and authority, of course, but they only have authority over you if you let them. Go way back on the podcast. I did a 3-part series on how you lose your authority, how you can regain it. Maybe we should revisit that and bring it about in a new context. The context is simple, though. It's all up to you. If you let it go that way, it will go that way. Very simple. You want to participate? Participate. Okay, don't go for the participation trophy, right? Where you get a trophy if whether you win or lose. Who cares? Go out there and actually participate. In all things. It doesn't have to be, you know, politics. Participate in your community. Participate with your family, with your friends. That is the congregation. That is the congregation. So if you allow these things to happen, it's because it's your fault. Okay? If you don't want to take responsibility, I don't care. It's still your fault. Everything that happens is a result of your actions. Now, of course, there is a plan in the background, and we haven't talked about this yet. We will at some point. But all these things evolve for a reason. And the plan doesn't mean that things are going to go perfectly well with you because you're a Christian or a Jew or a Muslim or a Buddhist or a Hindu or, you know, a Jain or Zoroastrian or whatever. That's not what it means. So in the future, we will have very technologically advanced civilizations that go out into space. And maybe it's like in The Expanse, right? People that mine the asteroid belt, they get extremely tall because of the lower gravity. And so they evolve to have, you know, be 8 foot tall and super skinny. Well, the problem then is they can't go to Earth because the gravity will basically crush them to death. That's fine. That's part of the system evolving. Some people will choose to be enhanced technologically. We see this already, right? There's Olympic athletes that were amputees, and they have these incredible blade legs that make them super fast. And I know there's been some discussion on this. There's discussion on things like transgender folks. What if a man decides to transition into a woman and they're an athlete? Is that fair for them to participate in female sports? Because naturally men are larger structured, right? Bigger bone, bigger muscles. That's just the natural aspect of things. And even if they transition, they still have some of this chemical biological system within them. And so they have an unfair, unnatural advantage just to participate in women's sports. Is that true? I don't know. I'm not a biologist or, you know, any of this stuff. I don't know. Some of the argument makes sense. But some of it is because we think of these things maybe in a kind of antiquated way. And this is, again, to reference Jordan Peterson, the dichotomy between the opposites in society, right? Between the left and the right. Where the left comes up with new ideas and the right is responsible for implementing them and making them work. This is also not a new idea, right? Plato talks about this philosopher king idea. I know some of you have very strong feelings about the idea of having a philosopher king and how great that would be to have a person of ideas, but you also need somebody to implement those ideas. That's why a lot of ancient cultures oftentimes had not one, but two kings. You had a king that was in charge of religious ceremonies, for example, and then a king that was in charge of war, of the military. And of course, oftentimes you end up, your culture advances in quotes, into having just the one king, and the one king that generally ends up taking over is the one that rules the military. Why? Because they have the physical might to do so. Ideas are, of course, very powerful. And if you're a very smart and cunning individual, you could, for sure, create a society that deals in these religious philosophical aspects by controlling the mind. This is another thing that's in the zeitgeist today with propaganda and things like that. That's a very fascinating topic. And part of it is very conspiratorial, so I urge you to be careful if you dive into it. But there is some very legitimate science. The science of propaganda is fascinating because as smart as we think we are, as capable, as important as we feel our free will is, much of that free will is simply an illusion. And so this will happen as we evolve into systems. Some people will choose this path, this logical path, and they will become something other than human eventually. Their biology will interact with the technology that they possessed, and their bodies will change. This is how evolution works. Evolution is, an ape gives birth to a human being one day. That's stupid. This is the argument that you get sometimes from creationists. It's a fallacy, right? It doesn't mean that a chimp gave birth to a man. Over hundreds and tens of thousands of years, small changes happen. And so, in essence, the new species might be almost indistinguishable from the previous one. But over time, it progresses, and these changes are disseminated, and so new species evolve. And sometimes through lack of physical contact, say in previous times, something like a mountain range or an island or a group of islands where species that originated from a common source no longer interbreed, they evolve in their own separate branches. Because see, it's the stressors that cause this evolution. If everything's peachy and perfect and utopian, things stay the same forever. Because there's nothing stressing your organism to change. But as we go into different planets, maybe to different galaxies, maybe some of us just decide to live on space stations in space, maybe some of us decide to go underground, right? Go read The Time Machine, fantastic book, in which far off humanity kind of branches off into a couple different species because they live on the ground. All these things are part of the natural process. And some of us may choose to not even go through this evolution, right? Because there's many different paths you can go. Some of us may choose to simply place our consciousness into vessels, which is very interesting. We recall back to the beginning of this episode, because in some essence, this is how it is. There is a divine consciousness placed into this animal vessel that we're in. And when you get to that place, things evolve in a very interesting way. And again, why I love sci-fi. Because now if you're just a consciousness that, you can back yourself up to, a server in Asia and a server in North America, a server in Australia. And, if your body dies, who cares? You have backups all over the place. You just download into a clone of yourself, or, you find some other body that you can replace their consciousness with yours. Then you really start getting into deep philosophical arguments about the nature of these things. But some folks may choose not to do any of these things. Some people may say, well, though everything is a mess, all is well, right? Anthony DeMello. I love the Earth. Earth is beautiful. Are we messing it up? Sure. Can we find a way to evolve through it? Of course. I love the Earth. Maybe some of these people that want to be half robots going to space, there's more room for us here, and we can fix some of this stuff that we've been destroying. And we can have tractors and cell phones, but we don't need to rely on them. We just need to rely on ourselves. See, now you have divergent paths of evolution. And you might have another path with genetics, right? CRISPR is a huge thing if you study genetics. A very simple way to manipulate genes in an organism's DNA. Some people might say, well, it's so hot, the sun's so bright. We need to get rid of the gene that causes pale skin, right? We need to increase the production of melanin in the skin. And so maybe a segment of the population gets darker to deal with the increased ultraviolet radiation. Or maybe we'll go into an ice age and people are like, it's so cold. We need to get hairier. Let's manipulate our genes. So now we're super hairy, short, stocky, Neanderthal-style humans. We're still human, but now we're hairy and short and stocky, muscular, big-boned, and we have bigger feet because there's a lot of snow and ice, and if you have bigger feet, you don't need snowshoes. So let's just do that. We'll evolve into that. Are you still then human? Are you human through any of these processes? And the answer to the question is, who cares? Yes and no. In the process of undergoing through these things, yes, you're still human. If you enhance yourself genetically, you're still human. You enhance yourself technologically, you're still human. You just have to do none of these things, you're still human. But there comes a point where you're no longer human. And what's so special about being human? What's so special about it? Because there's some text that said, well, now you're in charge of all the land and all the plants and all the animals. Well, guess what? If that's the case, we did a crappy job. Because we're destroying the environment, we're endangering species. Species are going extinct all the time. I just read an interesting article a few weeks ago about the bee collapse. I think something like 25% of all species have gone extinct since the 70s or 80s. And see, that's a big problem because you see, bees are actually important to the environment because plants have evolved to be to have their pollen disseminated through bees. There's no other organism that really does it. I mean, yes, like, you know, a bird might hit a flower with his leg or something, or feed on it. You know, you might brush by a plant and carry its seeds, you know, 10 miles or whatever. Yeah, there's that. But bees have speciated, specialized in this, and plants rely on it. So if that organism isn't around, what happens? Then you have real problems of ecological collapse, right? Now, is there a way that we can fix it? Sure, sure. But the point is, there's nothing inherently special about humanity. And at the same time, there is. Because, see, all things are special. This is where we get into this hippy-dippy line that you have to toe very, very closely, be very careful with, when everyone talks about everything is love, everyone's connected. And yes, but you don't get it. Right? You just see this in a superficial sense. Every aspect of a system is inherently integral to the evolution and survival of the system. And so if one part of the system no longer functions, then another part of the system has to come in and fill in that niche. And if you don't fill in that niche, the system collapses. Okay, now here we're talking about Earth and ecology and the species, human species, but this is true of any system. Okay, a mathematical system, a scientific model, a religious model, the universe, the way your body works. Okay, it's inherent in every system. Each part of a system has a role to play in the system. And if the part is not playing its role, the system will collapse. And so we need to learn what our role is. And whether we remain human as we are today or not is completely irrelevant to the evolution and survival of the system. And this is something that you have to keep very closely in mind, because even though this is a you know, if you go on Apple Podcasts, this is a spirituality podcast. Okay, that's the genre that I've chosen to put the show in. But spirituality does not mean we only talk about things of the soul, of fanciful ideas, of imagination, of divine entities, of ritual, of meditation, of practice, of morality. That's not what spirituality is. That might be the case for many folks. Again, I hate to pick on New Age folks, but in particular of the New Agey circles, where everything is fanciful, where everything kind of circles around this Luciferian archetype. Again, Luciferian, not a Satan, but in the anthroposophical meaning of Luciferian, of Lightbringer, of spiritual knowledge. That might be true in many of these circles. But the problem is, a lot of these circles are just feeding you bullshit, things that you want to hear. And if you only concern yourself with things that are nice and pretty and things that you want to hear, all that spirituality that you focus on means nothing. Spirituality is about becoming a better you. And whether you choose to become a better you through technology or genetics or prayer, practice, congregation, finding your connection to God, it's all the same. All the same. Spirituality is about bettering yourself so you can continue to better the system, continue to better the experience of God becoming God, of the universe continuing to evolve and change and become something else. There is no better or worse. That's why when I say become a better human, I often cringe when I say it. What does that mean? But that's what spirituality is. Don't focus too much on whether you lose your humanity or not. Because you could argue, in some sense, maybe when you reach mystical states, you're losing your humanity. You're losing some of that daily hustle and bustle that so many people focus on. So ultimately, what you want to do within yourself, within your mind, within your heart, within your soul, within your body, within your culture, within your society, is find a way to recenter yourself and to reach that Christ consciousness, as Steiner likes to put it. So, we're going to wrap it up here. We're going to dive back into Steiner in the future because it's fascinating. I love Steiner, and it's not just a religious thing. He's, of course, created the Waldorf schools and all this stuff, so he's an important figure, much more than just in religion and philosophy. So we're going to get back into him at some point and of course, dive back into these archetypes again because these archetypes are key in many regards. That's why usually all these things come in threes, right? We've talked about in terms of the Hermetic tradition about Osiris, Isis, and Thoth, Hermes, We've talked about mother, father, and child in terms of pre-Christian Gnostic ideas, and you see this even in mystical Judaism. You have the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit in Christianity. Usually these things come in threes, and there's a reason for that, right? Because that's what we try to do every day to better our human condition, is not delve too much in extremes, but find some way in the middle to achieve those goals. So I want to thank Bailey for sending the email. Again, she and I are still discussing. In fact, I need to reply to her latest one, and fascinating stuff. Got a couple more emails that I want to dive into as well. I've got one from Aaron that I received recently, and from Derek. So we'll be diving those in the near future. And I want to thank some people. Let's thank some people. Of course, I want to thank the patrons. You guys are awesome. You guys are very supportive, even through this rough time that I went through. If you want to support this podcast, then go to patreon.com/thealchemicalmind. You can support the show there at any level. I think they start at $1 a month. I don't even know. Just if you want to do that, go do that. You don't want to do it, that's fine. You can support the show by sharing the show with other folks. Share it with your friends, your family, your whoever. You want to share it? Share it. And begin having these discussions. Begin having these discussions with people around you. It's important to have this stimulation. I want to say like mental stimulation, but it's so much more than that, right? Because when you have these discussions with people, you're engaging all of you. You're engaging your body in the discussion, either typing or speaking. You're engaging your mind in the thought process. You're engaging your heart and your feelings, your soul, your emotions into these kind of things. And it's important to do this, to engage all of you in a society that's oftentimes focusing so much on just engaging the focus muscle, the attention muscle. How many YouTube videos or TikTok videos you can watch, or how many news websites you can read, and be careful with that stuff. I do want to thank some countries because the podcast has been growing every month since I began this podcast. It's been growing, and this began May or June of last year, and so now we're 8, 9 months into this experiment. And it's been awesome, and it's been growing every time. And just offhand, somebody sent me some Apple Podcast charts, and I was very surprised because the podcast is top 200 in basically every country that has a chart, top 100 in about a dozen, and even better than that in some countries. So in the Czech Republic, we're like top 10. Crazy. So thank you guys. So shout out to those of you in the Czech Republic, Děkuji. In Indonesia, Terima kasih. In Ireland, Gurumah Hagut. In Romania, Mulțumesc. In Korea, Kamsahamnida. And in Spain, Muchas gracias. That's gonna be it. If you want to reach out, email Martin at the Alchemical Mind. There's a Discord. There's a Patreon. All that stuff. All those links are at thealchemicalmind.com. And check out Indra's Web. IndrasWeb.org. It's a new social network that Mike and some friends from the Mind Escape podcast created. Great place. I'm hanging out in there a little bit. I'm not too active because I'm trying not to do too much social. I'm trying to listen to the silence and letting it speak to me. And I think that's all. Another important aspect of learning to experience new things is to listen to the silence. But thank you all for the continued support and for the continued growth on the podcast. It really means a lot to have people be interested. And if you don't agree, I'm totally cool with that. I don't expect us to agree, but at least if we can have these discussions, then we can all do better. So thank you. That will be it for now. Again, thank you for listening. I'll be back with another episode in about a week or so. As always, remember that you are it.